medicine really influences my poetry. And, you know, there are just days or hours when I really am overwhelmed by coming so close to that responsibility of encountering the ending of a life in a body and a consciousness. And it's just sometimes it's difficult to bear.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum. I'm Mary Stack, and today we're going to be exploring an organ that is of paramount importance to us all, the heart, that untiring pump which lies at the nexus of our physical and emotional well-being. While few could dispute its anatomical significance as a miraculous engine, a marvel of design unsurpassed by any human-made creation, with its resilience and precision, beating 100,000 times a day, it clocks up 3 billion beats if you live to be 100. But although it's got remarkable pumping function, and that's undeniable, its other attributes are not quite so well understood. It is known to be super sensitive, not just in responding to emotions, but also in creating them. And you can indeed die of a broken heart. Recent findings have revealed a much deeper connection between the heart and the brain than was previously realized. To help us unlock some of these mysteries, we have with us today a world expert in cardiac science who is Professor of Cardiac Pharmacology at Imperial College London. Sean Harding is author of a new book, The Exquisite Machine, The New Science of the Heart. Welcome, Sean.
Hi, thank you.
In addition, we'll be joined by physician and poet, Dr. Fadi Judah, who practices internal medicine at St. Luke's Baylor Medical Center in Houston, Texas. So welcome to you, Fadi.
Thank you.
We know all about the structure of the heart and what it's meant to do and the electrical rhythms and what have you. But it's first of all, it's got anatomical stuff. You know, it's got the defects, the electrical malformations. Then it's subject to disease. Then it's also subject and vulnerable to all sorts of stress and emotional upheaval. Let's have a talk about this mini brain that's in the heart, and also about this broken heart syndrome. I think a lot of people would be really interested about that.
So the heart is controlled by the generally speaking, by the system that you don't have to take any notice of. So the autonomic nervous system. So you've got the sympathy. It can be sped up by adrenaline, the sympathetic one. It can be slowed down again. The other one, as you need to do it. But also inside the heart, there's a little plexus of nerves, like a kind of mini brain, as you said. And that has got not only those nerves, but sensory nerves. And so it interacts with the central nervous system. So the heart, it can, in a sense, create emotion. So there's a thing called interoception, where you're sensitive to your body organ systems, and some people are more sensitive to others. So some people can know their heart rate all the time. Most of us can feel when our heart is pounding, when it's really racing. So you know you can feel that. So in a sense, that can tell us that we're frightened. So if you react so quickly to the low conscious level to something frightening, and you need to get very, very quickly. And so your autonomic nervous system is reacting extremely quickly. And then it's kind of telling you that you should run, your heart's racing. And so if you even play the sound of a racing heart to somebody and tell them it's their heart, then you can induce a panic attack in them. So, you know, reacting. And there's very clever experiments where they show one thing that people respond to a lot is frightened faces, not frightening faces, frightened faces, because that's the kind of contagion you would get in a crowd. You would see that somebody is frightened of something, and it makes evolutionary sense that you pick that up really, really quickly. And so if you play that to somebody, flash that up then, at the peak of their heartbeat, when your heart's beating hard, and or when the heart's relaxed within the same beat, you get a much bigger fear response by, you know, skin resistance and things at the top of the beat than you do at the bottom of the beat. So that's an amplification of the system. That's within one heartbeat.
Somebody's just written a question for us here. Obviously, the brain needs the heart, else it will expire due to oxygen deprivation. But does the heart need the brain, or can it function adequately without, as occurs under anaesthesia?
Yes, you can tell it. I mean, I've gone into the operating theatre when they're taking the, usually go to get the transplanted heart, the failing heart, and take that away for study while they're putting a donor heart in. And they sometimes just leave it on the side and you see it beating away there quite happily.
Wow.
And then we can take it back and we actually put it on a rig with liquid flowing through it and keep it going for some hours. They've got an organ, they've got something like that now to carry the hearts around in, so they're being perfused all the time and they will beat away. And they'll sometimes recover a bit actually if they're on that while they're being transported.
So the broken heart.
So this is really an extreme thing about the emotion. So I was talking about sort of a lower level one, but it's very true. And broken heart, because bereavement is the key thing. And there's various ones. There was somebody quite recently in one of the shootings, died very recently, very quickly after their child had been killed. You're much more likely to die on the day after your spouse has died or same day than you are any other day that year. And the risk sort of drops off with time over about 6 months. But the anniversary of the death, you'd said that the TED talk, the person was a woman, was looking at the photograph of her husband a couple of weeks later. So very clear that arguments, very strong as well. Football, there's a big spike in heart disease and this kind of thing during cup finals. About 30% increase on the cup final, particularly penalty shootouts. That's a bit different for UK sport from American football. But it's the same for all the sports. And I've got a great thing there about the missed penalty kick having an effect on a husband and wife. And so the syndrome you were talking about, that the woman had gone into hospital thinking they had a heart attack, and when they were imaged, they weren't having a heart attack, there was no blockage or anything, but just after a really stressful event, then you could see if you imaged in the right way, that the heart was contracting in a very odd way. It was beating really hard at the top and then ballooning out at the bottom. And that gives an acute heart failure. But and that's called Takotsubo because it was first seen in Japan and it looked like an octopus pot.
That's right.
So that's the weird name for that. The thing about this, there is a mortality associated with it. It's about 5%. But the rest of the people will recover. There's not much to do, actually. Most of the things that doctors would do would make it worse. And so not doing things is the right thing for this one. And
therapy, really. Just acknowledging that they are having an emotional crisis rather than a heart attack, which is what's going on.
But they've got something wrong with the heart. It's not that they're imagining it. It's got something wrong with their heart. And then gradually it wears off after some days or weeks. And so that's been very interesting for me. And one of the things being that it's 80 to 90% postmenopausal women. But there's another thing that's also called broken heart syndrome, where people just get ventricular fibrillation, just their heart, goes into overload, and they die instantly, in a few minutes, they collapse and that's it. They're not defibrillated. If you're defibrillated, you can be saved. But sudden cardiac death, and that's 80 to 90% male. So that mostly men get that. So our hypothesis has been that Takotsubo is kind of the least worst thing you can happen to you. You're kind of getting this, your heart's shutting down temporarily to stop these arrhythmias, to stop itself getting damaged more. And we did an experiment in the lab where we anaesthetized some rats and we gave them a dose of, it's adrenaline is the thing that does this. We gave them a dose from an EpiPen, or a rat-sized EpiPen really, not a whole EpiPen. And they got the Takotsubo syndrome. And we had worked out what that mechanism was. And we tried to block it. And by blocking it, we flipped them into sudden cardiac death.
Oh, dear.
So they're still under, they just died under the anaesthetic. And so we stopped doing that, actually. So obviously that wasn't a good idea. So I think it's that you know, you if you prevent them going into Takotsubo, then they will go into the sudden cardiac death syndrome. So it's kind of a slightly protective thing.
Right. In your book, you've got a poem by E. Cummings, a beautiful poem, I Carry Your Heart With Me.
During the regenerative medicine thing, while we were trying to work out what was happening, people were looking at the stem cells, that the stem cells are naturally in the body. And it seems that when you're having a baby, the baby's stem cells can cross the placental barrier and go into the mother. And they can stay there for a long time. They've been found in, say, when women are having hip operations, when they're much older, you know, decades after the pregnancy, they can find the baby stem cells. They find it because of the, if it's a male baby, a boy, then you can see the male gene in there. So it stands out from the mother. But it does happen for girl babies too. And so you can find these decades later. And in women who've had breast cancer surgery, they found the baby stem cells in their in the wound for the you know, surgical wound, the breast cancer. So we don't know, but that's the idea, that they're certainly there. Maybe they've got some kind of regenerative function. Just don't know. But what it means is that you have your, and I like this, the women who have had babies are chimeras. They have a mixture of people's cells, so they're not just one person. So in a very real sense, this poem is literally true. I carry your heart with me. I carry it in my heart. So I should read it for you now. I carry your heart with me. I carry it in my heart. I am never without it. Anywhere I go, you go, my dear, and whatever is done by me is only your doing, my darling. I fear no fate, for you are my fate, my sweet. I want no world, for beautiful, you are my world, my true. And it's you are whatever a moon has always meant, and whatever a sun will always sing is you. Here is the deepest secret that nobody knows. Here is the root and the bud of the bud, and the sky of a tree called life, which grows higher than a soul can hope or a mind can hide. And this is the wonder that's keeping the stars apart. I carry your heart. I carry it in my heart.
That's beautiful. So I've read on more than one occasion of accounts of individuals who have received heart transplants and then start to assume characteristics or behavior of the donor that gave them the heart. I mean, quite remarkably different behavior. Can you in any way account for this scientifically? You know, like muscle memory or something. Maybe Sean will say there's muscle memory in the heart tissue. I don't know. Or do you have anything to say about it? So I'm going to ask each of you to speak about that.
I'm skeptical, I have to say. But of course, having a heart transplant will make you feel so much better, so much quicker. That you might feel like a different person. So you know, I'm going to fall on the science line here. And there are, I have to say, there is one operation where you can have two hearts, where you have a heterotopic transplant. And so sometimes in the first days of transplantation, the hearts weren't big enough or strong enough. And so instead of replacing the donor heart for the failing, they would put the donor heart in series with the failing. And so it would be plumbed into the abdomen and on the aorta there yes. And so the favorite trick was to get a medical student and try to get them to understand why there were two pulses there, you know, the Doctor Who operation basically. But from a scientific point of view, I would have said probably, and we have done a lot of transplants now. Probably, I don't believe it.
What about you, Fadi?
Yeah, I am also skeptical because I think there are too many variables. the violence of the immunosuppressive medications is a thing of its own, what it changes in the body. The as Professor Harding said, the fact that your health is better, sort of the elation or spirituality of survival. These are, you know, quite different things. Until we are able to study the patterns of the donor heart, you know, when you don't really know who's going to be the donor heart, and see, well, some of those characteristics exist in the recipient, but there are just too many variables. However, I would like to say that there is this French philosopher by the name of Jean-Luc Nancy, who has a lovely book called Corpus, and the last chapter in it is called The Intruder. And he is a heart transplant recipient. And he talks in it beautifully, not necessarily about his changes, but what it means, what happens to the indoctrinated being of being in one's body at one point, then suddenly you have an intruder within you. And so it is not necessarily down to that particular heart or the donor. You know, but it is an essay worth reading, The Intruder by Jean-Luc Nancy.
Okay. You refer more than once to the lack of words that exists for feelings or situations as a doctor. And there's one that I would like you to read. It's The Mother Between Us. And in this poem, you seem to sum up in some ways the inadequacy of medicine. So I wonder if you wouldn't mind reading from Hope is a Mother.
Sure. So it's a longish poem. I'll read from the part you requested. Hope is a mother. I have a mother too, but I am not the history of those who betrayed you. When I say that plasma and antibiotics can no longer show anyone what healing is. What healing is an answer that you're a stranger to. Yet this I concede, your sorrow is greater than mine, your grief to come. Between us is your mother and what she was, the twine to commence their meeting. You have a day job, can't visit her during my working hours, and I'm the unknown caller you've come to know well. Or the quarantine made us smartphone pals. The summoning of the soul to exit a body, to enter a body in an afterlife or none. The inevitable that never ceases to astonish.
That's powerful stuff. In some ways, do you have to keep that sense of astonishment and wonder, not just to be a good poet, but to be a good doctor?
Yes, I think, it's a struggle to keep it in a sort of a very administered bureaucratic existence, even, you know, for clinical medicine. But it is a struggle because, you know, since the Victorian age, we've suppressed sex, we've suppressed nature, and we've suppressed death. And I think in the aspect of, you know, on the death aspect, we don't really have these conversations. I mean, there is this kind of, you know, if life does not triumph over death, as in the, you know, that this is sort of one of the messages and problematic messages of the modern age we live in about medicine and the biopolitics, the power of life over death is sort of some of the complexity that we live in. And you can't talk, we can't as a society find compassion and humility in dying. We only find defeat and suffering. And it's overwhelming when you see it, maybe in a personal level with my fellow citizens or city mates or, but it's also more complex and painful. And when you see it, in many places in the country, but also across the world, where people don't even have access to basic care. For example, you know, just to be provocative, maybe not so provocative, we spend so much on transplant medicine, but politics prevent us from providing basic antibiotics to children all over the world dying from absolutely preventable deaths. So we're missing something in the way that we can face up to our relationship to dying. It's not about giving up. It's actually about a greater compassion. And I don't want to sound like I'm, you know, the best doctor that anyone can can encounter, but it's just worth saying these things, I think.
So one of your newer poems that you sent me, "There is no word for you in my other language," which I think speaks to what I'm saying. So here you're referring to sort of the limits of linguistic translation, of transferring a meaning from one language to another. But you're also speaking, I think, to the fact that the language of love is actually wordless.
Correct, yes. And I'll just read the poem. "There's no word for you in my other language. Seasons are four, and four the rooms in the heart. I will not stay long. Or maybe I shouldn't rush. The heart has vaults and secret corridors. They may keep me a while. Clarity contains the unknown heart in which I am a passing blood. The heart with its windows and doors, pegs and cords that no pumping topples is not the one I seek, and also not the blown heart. I seek the quiet dark of it, the guide that leads my listening to a hidden pulse I shouldn't rush. Blood longs to begin again in passion with falling in the dark. Have you heard it murmur in the rooms of the heart? What did it say as it pooled on the run? My heart plays at giving with hearts that play at taking in the dark rooms of the heart."
I love that. I love the rooms, the chambers, the occupancy. It's very cool. So I think this is I asked you this before and you hesitated about whether being a poet makes you a better doctor, and you kind of laughed dryly at the thought. But what I meant by that was, does it make you perhaps more empathetic or more conscious of things like silence, and the importance of silence? This doctor today in this heartache TED talk said he realized that he talked too much, that he gave the average patient 16 seconds when they came in the room before he started talking. So he never actually listened to them. And he said that he's gotten much better. So I just bring this up because, you know, the spaces in your togetherness idea. Do you think perhaps you are a more compassionate doctor because you write?
I mean, the reason I, you know, privately laughed Riley, as you say, is because if I am better, then it is because, not because of the poetry per se, but because of age, at least for me, and time and other external factors. And because there are many wonderful, kind, patient, and clinically superb physicians, colleagues who are not poets. And they're not anything else other than, you know, they're primarily in a sort of a professional or artisan way, anything else but physicians. So I don't want to, in my case, attribute — the arrow doesn't go for me from poetry into medicine, but the other way. I think that people's stories, listening to them, or encountering that intensity of hope and despair, says a lot and teaches me a lot as far as being a poet, being a listener. And I use it in my poems. And I think whether I use it in my poems or not, I would learn to be better the next time with other patients. But being a writer, you're somewhat of a hunter, opportunist, you're listening to the world. There is a selfishness in this kind of joy for, oh, what a story to tell, or what a feeling to recapture. And sometimes it's my own poetry is my own survival from medicine, mini survival, because the intensity of days or hours when I really am overwhelmed by coming so close to that responsibility of encountering the ending of a life in a body and a consciousness and all that surrounds it, you know, the family and so forth. And it's just sometimes it's difficult to bear. So I think maybe medicine really influences my poetry and it sort of sometimes saves me from myself a little bit.
Well, it's all benefit, I have to say, that you combine the two so well. Although you did say, which surprised me, that if you had to choose between medicine and writing, that you would choose
writing.
So the reason why, because this culture tends to devalue the humanities and the importance of something like poetry. It just is, oh, are you doing accounting? Are you doing computing? Are you going to be a lawyer or a doctor? Everything else is kind of like, it's nice, but you don't need, it's not essential.
I didn't say that to spite culture. I think for me, it goes back to the original heart. I've been I graduated from medical school in 1996. It's 2 decades and counting of me being a physician in one capacity or another, and done Doctors Without Borders and done clinics, hospital works, emergency room work. And I feel like, well, you know, I live in a structured system where, frankly, I am not essential as a physician. There's, you know, I come, I go, I've already done sort of my societal service. I've learned so much so it feels to me that I'm just ready to return to my original heart and see where a fuller life in writing would take me. You know, that's primarily the reason. There's less violence in writing, I think, than in encountering the difficulties of administered modern medicine in a corporate capital structure.
Wow. Well, maybe you'll do what Dr. Professor Harning's just done and write the book.
I have to say that one of the things about writing the book is for everybody is to try and write something that people might actually want to read, rather than the kind of things we have to write for science, which is more like writing equations, honestly, and to have some adjectives in there even, and maybe that'll be a bridge to something even a bit. I don't know, that my emotions have now been too tamped down by years of science, but to try and find my way back to the heart. Yeah,
that's nice. So I'm actually going to thank Professor Sean Harding from Imperial College, Dr. Fada Judith, who joined us from Texas, Houston, Texas. Took time out of your busy lives in separate time zones to share your insights and poetry. Cambridge Forum is made possible through the generosity of Herbert and Dorothy Vetter, the Lowell Institute, the Mass Cultural Council, Cambridge Community Foundation, and you. So if you'd like to donate or sign up to the members list, go to the website, which is www.cambridgeforum.org. So I'd like to thank everybody who joined us and say I hope to see everybody again soon.